White Christian nationalism is insidious because it's embedded into the social fabric of our society. They're really focused on infiltrating systems of governance. These are communities that will work their way into secular institutions and transform them from the inside out. Local elections are a whole nother thing. And that's where you have that grassroots movement. That's where you get those weird hybrid formations of fascism emerging. We're not taking seriously the threat of these sort of hybrid forms of fascism that are rising in the United States, then before we know it, we may see another January 6th.
Welcome to episode 136 of the Refuse Fascism podcast, a podcast brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of the show. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in the United States. In today's episode, we're sharing an interview with Dr. Sarah Riccardi Swartz, Assistant Professor of Religion and Anthropology at Northeastern University. But first, thanks to everyone who goes the extra step and rates and reviews our show on Apple Podcasts, shares and comments on social media or YouTube. It helps us reach more listeners, and we read everyone. Here are a couple messages from the last week. Over at YouTube, in response to episode 134, which was an interview with Bradley Onishi, at Wacky Mackie Boy commented, "Excellent episode. This content creates hope to fight the despair caused by the complacency of privileged liberals, progressives to this gathering threat of fascism." Thank you, Wacky Mackie Boy. And if you don't already, folks, subscribe to our YouTube channel so that you'll get the latest episodes there if that's where you like to listen. We also got this message this past week from Scott. Quote, "I have had the pleasure of listening to the Refuse Fascism podcast off and on for over 2 years. Sometimes I miss an episode. Then I always regret it and don't feel up to date. So I go to past episodes and catch up. Sam, you are constantly a breath of fresh air, truth and hope in this fucking morass of denial, lies, and conciliation. I just listened to episode 135, the aftermath of the midterms, and really enjoyed the comments by you, Coco, and Paul, especially when you said, quote, people need to confront what is real, end quote. I learned from and enjoyed listening to this episode and realized when Coco said, quote, these Christian fascists are making life hell for women and girls right now, end quote. She is so right. People need to get out of their personal and political lanes, act in the name of humanity, and refuse to accept a fascist America. Thank you, Scott. And we agree. Out of these lanes, into the streets, refuse it. All right, so after listening to today's episode, go help us find more people who want to refuse fascism by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts and encouraging your friends and family who listen to do the same. Subscribe, follow so you never miss an episode. And of course, continue all that sharing and commenting on social media. It's giving season, y'all, and I want to shout out Mark, Ron, Joan, Miriam, Lisa, Linda, Ken, Richard, Marsha, Damien, Renee, William, Jennifer, and Linda with an I. I forgot to say the other Linda was with a Y. For giving this past period since we've been off the air. Thank you for supporting this show and the work of Refuse Fascism. And we have a special deal for you, dear podcast listeners. So listen up. With a donation of $35 or more to Refuse Fascism to support this weekly independent podcast. When you give, you will get a Refuse Fascism beanie, one for yourself and one to gift a friend or a loved one. Give them for holiday gifts, give them just for winter seasonal greetings, give them for whatever you want to gift them for. To do so, head over to refusefascism.org, hit that donate button, and make sure to include your address so we can mail it to you in time for holiday giving season. All right. Before we get to today's interview, we have to talk about where we are right now in relation to the fascist threat. And we need to start with the new frontiers in normalizing anti-Semitism. Since we last aired, Trump, hosted Holocaust-denying white supremacist Nick Fuentes and anti-Semitic rapper Ye at Mar-a-Lago. As Jonathan Greenberg tweeted earlier this week, quote, in case anyone wonders where today's fascist-led GOP is headed, Kanye West and Nick Fuentes, as well as their gracious Mar-a-Lago host, insurrectionist and unindicted terrorist Donald Trump, are here to remind us, end quote. On the Alex Jones show this week, Ye expressed his admiration for Adolf Hitler. Jones offered West some friendly cover, saying, quote, you're not a Nazi. You don't deserve to be called that and demonized, end quote. To which Ye said, quote, well, I see good things about Hitler, end quote. And later added, quote, every human being has value that they brought to the table, especially Hitler, end quote. Throughout the course of the interview, West made multiple overt anti-Semitic statements, denied the Holocaust happened, and said that Nazis, quote, did good things too. We got to stop dissing the Nazis all the time, end quote. And I think it's informative to hear what Christian fascists are having to say about this anti-Semitic declaration. Andrew Torba, the founder and CEO of Gab, social media platform, Haven for Hate and Disinformation, along with being the author of Christian Nationalism, A Biblical Guide for Taking Dominion and Discipling Nations, which we discuss in today's interview, praises Ye for his anti-Semitic performance on the Alex Jones show. And I don't mean performance in the sense that he doesn't mean it. I mean performance in the fact that, like, it was a dramatic display. Torba stated, quote, Ye is a master marketer. He knows what he is doing. He is getting all eyes on him so he can point all eyes to Christ and to the truth, end quote. Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber made a very clarifying statement on why we should pay attention to this recent anti-Semitic onslaught. Quote, these are not fringe outliers sending emails from their parents' garage or idiots no one has ever heard of. When influential, mainstream, cultural, political, and even sports icons normalize hate speech, everyone needs to be very concerned, end quote. And Amy Spitalnik, executive director of Integrity First for America, one of the groups that backed a lawsuit against organizers of Unite the Right, Charlottesville rally, stated, quote, what's even more dangerous than Nazis with torches chanting Jews will not replace us is when we have political leaders and others espousing those same conspiracy theories in increasingly normalized ways, end quote. And since there seems to be some confusion, Alex Jones is not less of a Nazi than Ye. It's that he knows what words not to say. His career, his fame, is derived from platforming the most grotesque and cruel bigotry, fomenting xenophobia, anti-Semitism, white supremacy, patriarchy, homophobia, and transphobia. And let's be clear, the GOP didn't drop their white supremacy, become less anti-Semitic, or finally come to their senses when they at last dropped the tweet they had praising Kanye. They are determined to have an iota of plausible deniability while relying and providing a heavy diet of calculated dog whistle bigotry. Neo-Nazi trolls are clamoring to return to Twitter as Musk grants amnesty to suspended accounts. In addition to welcoming back Trump, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and others, neo-Nazi site The Daily Stormer is back on Twitter. This is all happening while suspending prominent anti-fascist accounts. Twitter did not suspend Ye's account until this week after he tweeted a picture of a swastika merged with the Star of David. As reported by Shira Frankel and Kate Conger for the New York Times, based on research by the ADL, before Musk bought Twitter, slurs against Black Americans showed up on social media services an average of 1,282 times a day. And after Musk took ownership, they jumped to 3,876 times a day. Slurs against gay men appeared on Twitter 2,506 times a day on average before the Musk takeover, and they rose to 3,964 times a day after Musk's takeover. Anti-Semitic posts referring to Jews or Judaism soared more than 61% in the 2 weeks after Musk acquired the site. QAnon content has returned to Twitter, with users spreading conspiracy theories, disinformation, and promoting QAnon events. Many prominent figures within the QAnon movement have already returned, and boast thousands of followers between them. We'll be continuing to talk about the Muskification Twitter and its relationship to the threat of a fascist America in future episodes. Please continue to send us your questions, ideas, thoughts on guests, articles that should be referenced about this topic. Turning to Mango Mussolini, Trump, we just have to mention briefly that earlier this week, Trump gave his support to coup participants, folks that were involved in the deadly January 6th insurrection. He said in a video played during a fundraiser that, quote, people have been treated unconstitutionally, in my opinion, and very, very unfairly, and we're going to get to the bottom of it, end quote. Then Trump, just yesterday, Saturday morning, called to be reinstated as president, declared the winner of the 2020 election or to have a new election immediately. Over on the Truth Social, he posted, quote, so with the revelation of massive and widespread fraud and deception in working closely with big tech companies, the DNC, and the Democratic Party, do you throw the presidential election results of 2020 out and declare the rightful winner, or do you have a new election? A massive fraud of this type and magnitude allows for the termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution. Our great founders did not want and would not condone false and fraudulent elections, end quote. And what was this revelation that he was speaking about? It was the Musk release of the internal Twitter files on Friday night, which detailed already public known information about the company's deliberation surrounding the New York Post's publication of files from Hunter Biden shortly before the 2020 election. It is extremely dangerous for the former president and fascist in chief, the current GOP frontrunner, to spew this unhinged fascist lunacy. And let's be clear, it is even more dangerous for it to be ignored or laughed off as pathetic. With that, I want to urge folks to stay vigilant, to not allow this white supremacy, this anti-Semitism, this misogyny, this fascism to be normalized, to be accommodated to. With that, here is my conversation with Sarah. Today, excited to welcome on to the show Dr. Sarah Riccardi-Schwartz. She's an assistant professor of religion and anthropology at Northeastern University. I am really looking forward to getting into continuation of topics that we've been exploring regarding where are we now, post the midterms, still reeling from horrific attacks, not just one, but multiple attacks or attempted attacks on LGBTQ siblings, still reeling from anti-Semitism that is more overt and more rampant than we've ever seen in my life. There's a lot to get into as it relates to what on this show we refer to as the Christian fascist threat. I couldn't think of anybody better to talk to you about this than Sarah.
Thanks for having me on.
I wanted to start with a larger question. In my opinion, it affects the way that people understand and therefore act in response to this dangerous situation. Amongst the Christian extreme right, there are diverse and often overlapping sects, groups, interests, and coalitions. In two groups we've spoken about in depth on the show are white Christian nationalists and dominionists. And I was hoping that you could talk to us a little bit about what are the meaningful differences amongst these categories? Why should we care? And what unites the Christian right? And maybe we could just start with what are the meaningful differences amongst these categories?
I think if you're looking at meaningful differences, they're usually theological and they're not going to have that much social difference. And what I mean by that is each of these groups are sort of united because they have a similar end game or a similar social trajectory in mind. Perhaps the dominionists think that they can create a new earth before Christ comes back, which is in opposition to premillennialism, which is the standard Christian doctrine on the return of Christ. But that doesn't really have any sort of social impact in how they unite or how they form coalitions. So I would say sometimes we want to parse out the sort of theological differences these groups have. And I certainly have to do that because I work on reactive Orthodox, which are far right Orthodox converts who also form coalitions with white Christian nationalists and dominionists. But at the end of the day, their commonalities, I think, are more important than their differences. their focus on sort of creating a social schematic that tracks with what they assume is right has a lot of similarities across these disparate groups.
That makes a lot of sense. I was wondering, what is the value in people understanding what white Christian nationalist aims are, what dominionist aims are, and how that impacts their role in American politics?
Well, I think dominionists are fascinating because if you think about what's going on in terms of politics, and the midterms didn't, I think, turn out well for some dominionists who were running, but they're really focused on infiltrating systems of governance. Dominionists have this idea that there's these seven mountains. I'm sure you've talked about this extensively on your podcast already, or the seven sort of hills that you infiltrate of society. So politics being one of them. So if you're thinking about what's good to know about dominionism, these are communities that will work their way into secular institutions and transform them from the inside out. And that is good if you're thinking about how do I combat this on the ground, right? At the grassroots level. In terms of white Christian nationalism, we have to remember that some dominionists are also white Christian nationalists and some white Christian nationalists are also dominionists. You have this overlapping theological or ideological components. White Christian nationalism is insidious because, as Phil Gorski and Sam Perry have talked about extensively, it's been here since the beginning, right? It's part of coloniality. It's part of American exceptionalism. It's embedded into the social fabric of our society, in part because of systemic racism, but also in part because of the privilege of Protestantism in America.
Do you think that there's more than the white supremacy that unites these different sects?
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, I work with a group that would say, we're not white supremacists, but then the discourse is exceptionally anti-Semitic. It's racist. It smacks of white supremacy that we understand in the sort of long history of American white supremacy and white nationalism. But of course, there's more. We see that in the attempts to curate how women should govern their own bodies. We see that in the blatant homophobia and transphobia that's pervasive right now. So it's not just about white supremacy, it's about sort of heteronormative masculine supremacy, I would argue at the end of the day.
Can you talk more about that and why you think that's a focal point?
If you think about Mastriano, the way he and his wife talked during his campaign for governor of Pennsylvania, it was exceptionally noticeable that his wife sort of privileged the space of the masculine within the conversations that she had with their constituency. I would argue that's a perfect example of how this is not just about whiteness, but it's about white masculinity and white domination and heteronormative masculine domination at the end of the day. And I mean, there's a million examples of that we can find, but I think it was horrific. But what I loved about Mastriano's campaign was the fact that everything we talk about in terms of dominionism and white Christian nationalism and white supremacy, whiteness discourse, it was all there in his campaign, just in real time for everybody to see. And what's shocking for me is that in sort of the analysis of his campaign by journalists, certainly the religious overtones were there. When he was praying, journalists were on it, they were analyzing it, but they weren't analyzing as much the sort of masculine gender dynamics of his campaign. And that was really frustrating for me because these are intersectional issues. And if we're not looking at all of them, we're not getting a complete picture of what's actually happening.
I think that's a really important point. I did a lot of reading of people's coverage on Mastriano and a lot of articles that walked people through what this symbol meant in terms of religiosity, what that symbol meant. And much of it was interesting, right? I learned a lot through it. I do think that there continues to be a failure to recognize the subtle, and in his case, not so subtle, role of the most vicious forms of patriarchy, and how that intersects with a lot of his very horrifying aims and those who surround him that support that. I think that we were talking before we were recording, and I was noting that I'm in Pennsylvania. I was very relieved that he is not the governor. I think there was, in the run-up, like a lot of, we'll cover Mastriano as an oddity.
Yeah.
And then when he loses, we will dismiss him and his people. I think that that's something that's been done repeatedly. I'd love to hear your thoughts on why are we still struggling to take dominionist Christian nationalists seriously?
That is the question I ask myself repeatedly. I think what many saw across journalism and media and scholarship, what we felt is relief in many respects, was also tempered by some of us because we recognized that there are so many like Mastriano who have won seats. Right around the election, NBC News was projecting that 195 of Trump-backed candidates won their races and only 30 lost. But that is important because a lot of the candidates who won those 195 seats are exceptionally similar ideologically or overlapping ideologically with Mastriano.
Including in the Dominionism, would you say?
Well, I would say it depends. They may have ideological values that are similar, but they may not call themselves Dominionists. We have to remember, like, Dominionism is just sort of an ideological component of a certain type of Christian theology. One might hold the values of, hey, we need to infiltrate the government and put in our Christian values. You see this sort of small scale at school board meetings where moms come to the meetings. They are very angry about CRT and they'll say things like, this does not reflect my Christian values. And so their goal then is often they'll say, well, I think I'm going to run for a seat. Their goal is to potentially transform that school board, transform the school district, but they may not align with the actual institutions of Dominionism itself. But the impulse to transform their particular political space in that school board has the same impulse as Dominionism does. If we look at folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene, she won her seat again, and she has a very similar impulse to Mastriano that essentially the United States has fallen into progressive secularism. We have to transform it. How do we do that? We bring Christian values into the government. Now, I've never heard Marjorie Taylor Greene call herself a Dominionist, but that ideological principle is Dominionist in nature.
I think that is a really helpful example. And I think just like, in many ways, Mastriano, she is laughed at. She is ridiculed. And I'm not saying that she's not deserving of ridicule, plenty deserving of ridicule, but she's not taken seriously.
Yeah.
Mocked, but not thoroughly rebutted.
Or thoroughly interrogated. Even right. Scholars don't take her seriously sometimes.
Exactly. It's like, oh, that's goofy. She's a goofy or stupid or all of this. Meanwhile, you know who does take her seriously? Kevin McCarthy, who is planning to put her back on committees, who is listening closely to what she's saying. So there are people who are taking her seriously. And I think that there's, I need to question, why is it that not just the press, you're saying that it's scholars too, but I think it's very much the press that is just training people to laugh her off.
Well, I mean, the problem is we did that with Trump early on, and that was no laughing matter by January 6th.
Or the host of things that were done before them. It was not a laughing matter building a wall. It was not a laughing matter, Muslim. It was not a laughing matter to staff the court with justices who were overt in their plans to decimate abortion rights. And I think that you can be a goon and a fascist. You can be both. There are a lot of historians that will point out often ridiculous, laughable things that Hitler exemplified and yet was incredibly dangerous. I think that there's many, many examples. Trump is a great one of laughing it off, mocking it, and not confronting the danger. We're seeing the same with Marjorie Taylor Greene, not that she's the only person that we see this with, like Lauren Boebert.
It's done with women. There's definitely a gender dynamic to this, because if you notice, the press takes seriously DeSantis. They take seriously that DeSantis will probably try to run, or I'll listen to pundits and they'll be like, well, it would be wise if DeSantis would wait to run till the next cycle, because then he might actually win. And I'm like, are you listening to what you're saying? Right. And DeSantis holds a lot of the same, you know, ideological policies in mind that Marjorie Taylor Greene does, that Lauren Boebert does, that Trump certainly does. He's just perhaps far more sophisticated in the way he promotes and pushes these policies through. But look at the bills that have passed recently in Florida and look at the outright homophobia, transphobia, and just the ridiculous emphasis on CRT being taught in K-12 schools, which those of us who are in academia know that critical race theory is generally not even taught in an intro class, often taught at law schools, primarily. To even like bring that into the public discourse is just so blatantly racist. But for some reason, the press seems to like DeSantis. Yes, I agree. He sort of epitomizes that conservative public political figure, but ideologically, he is compatriots with all of these figures that seem laughable to the press. Absolutely, there's, I think, a gender dynamic. There's also this dynamic of charisma and caricature that we use with Trump. Trump is dynamic. He has charisma, even though some of us don't like it. He is a caricature of himself. Whereas DeSantis is more serious. He seems even keeled, even though his policies are very radical. And so I think that the press sort of leans into, okay, he seems serious. He seems like he knows what he's doing. Whereas these women don't know what they're doing. And this cartoon of a man doesn't know what he's doing.
I think that that's really clarifying. I wanted to loop back to some of what you were touching on regarding the midterms. The Republic fascist slate, as we call it on the show, in the midterm elections included more open and extreme Christian fascists than ever before. And while they didn't sweep, that didn't seem to hurt them. And I wanted your thoughts on how are you viewing this? How do you think that we should be understanding what happened?
I think you're absolutely right. It didn't hurt them. The assumption is that losing or not winning fully has somehow hurt them. It hasn't. Bobar still got her seat. Taylor Greene has still got her seat. Vance picked up a really pivotal seat. And Vance is just one of these figures that, again, he's Trumpian. And yet he appeals to a broad conservative constituency. You know, he's got that sort of folksy Appalachian charm. He's got a bestseller. He seems even keeled and serious enough to be a politician. And the press does not seem to have a problem with him winning. And there's no interrogation of, look, this is a candidate who has had horrific views on gender, on race, on class disparities. And he is also backed by Trump. So I agree with you that, you know, at first blush, I think that the election seemed to be more helpful for the liberals or the Democrats. But if you actually get into the numbers, I mean, that 195 seats is not even including local elections. Local elections are a whole nother thing. And that's where you have that grassroots movement. That's where you get those weird hybrid formations of fascism emerging, where you have, you know, a Proud Boy or, you know, a one percenter or a Dominionist getting on a school board or running for mayor and actually transforming communities from the ground up. And so I think that I am not as positive as some are about the trajectory of this politics in our country since the midterms. I think that even this off cycle in 2023, there are seats that are up. I know the governorship of Kentucky is up in 2023. Andy Beshear is a fabulous governor, but there are a lot of conservatives in the state of Kentucky that weren't happy with his COVID protocols. They were too constrictive for them. And so who's going to be the next governor of Kentucky? That's an important thing to think about. I think they're going to build on the momentum, quite frankly. I think that we're going to see more far-right Christians take office in 2023. And I think in 2024, who knows, now that Trump's on the slate again, but we'll see.
I think that, you know, your points about who has held on to power and the lessons that that should teach us in terms of the fact that that continues to have popularity, plus the way that gerrymandering and a bunch of other factors work, that is allowed to go down. So I want to be clear that this is not like me saying it's the will of the people, whatever, that we're all fascist. That's not what I'm saying. So I think that that is instructive. I think it's instructive to look at how many Trump-backed candidates were victorious, how many election deniers won. I think that there's also this factor that people struggle to recognize, that this movement isn't limited to the sphere of electoral politics, that their momentum isn't limited to who wins, who loses a seat, that this is only one of their many, if you will, means of impacting or seizing power. And I think that we have sadly seen one of their other tools, which is acts of violence, you know, what we saw at Club Q.
Yeah.
That was another example. You know, I think that people struggle with seeing that the full range of what these forces do, which
I agree,
does include violence and is not limited to acts of violence either.
Right.
There's ways people are terrorized without acts of violence.
I also think when we focus on electoral politics, we often think about who's winning or losing, you know, Senate seats or whatever. And we're not thinking about state politics as much. We're not thinking about legislation passed at the state level. I mean, that's so important given like the anti-trans bills that have been passed in Texas recently and other states that are denying gender affirming care. These bills that are passing are important because if we see a transformation of our institutional politics at the level of the Senate and the House in the coming years in terms of shifting farther right, we have to remember that one of the things that the right loves is to give power back to the states. And if the states are then the ones deciding who's allowed to marry whom, that is going to be a big deal. And so I think sometimes we fail to look at state politics enough and to understand what's happening from the ground up. It was really interesting. I was having a conversation with colleagues yesterday, and they said, well, when I talk to students about politics, they're always thinking about electoral politics. I was like, absolutely. If you put politics in like a syllabus title, they're immediately thinking electoral politics. They're not thinking the politics of the body, the politics of religion, the politics of sexuality and gender. They're thinking about electoral politics. And so you are absolutely right that this violence that is perpetuated by electoral politics is also expressed in a multitude of different ways on the ground.
And yeah, and often that escalates in response, yes, you know, as you're saying, to a loss. It's not that they feel a sense of defeat and then for back down or retreat at all.
Right.
I was also thinking that, you know, this kind of connects to what we were talking about, Marjorie Taylor Greene and that crew, but there's been like a new level, I feel like, of normalization in terms of the way that people viewed the midterms, because it wasn't as bad as people feared in terms of the most extreme taking. People, I feel, have a certain period of time, there was a sense of like recognizing, naming the fascist threat, the risk to what people perceive as democracy in this country. And now I feel like there's like, we're back to normal.
Yeah.
We did a reset and we're good now for a couple of years. What is that about? How far does this go?
I think a lot of that, to be honest, Sam, has to do with our 24-hour news cycle. We're so inundated with information and it becomes overwhelming, both positively and negatively.
That makes sense. You know, I feel like example would be the fact that fucking heroes in Iran who are still in the streets, you know, these women that are still like risking their fucking lives every day. And I feel like it's not even in major newspapers anymore.
Right.
As like a story.
Yeah. A few women on TikTok shaved their heads and then it was out of the system of American social consciousness. You had a few influencers who were like, this is important. We stand by these women. This is amazing. Yeah. Empowerment. And then it's gone.
It's
right. And because the feed has updated, there's other things to think about. Right. And I understand that the United States is going through severe economic difficulties. And we have our own sort of political wars that we're waging ideologically with each other and sometimes actually happening on the ground in violent manifestations here among people. But at the same time, to not be attuned to what's happening in the global sphere is to not be really focusing on what's happening in the United States, because we are not unmoored in the United States from global politics. It's all connected. We live in a globalized world.
It's really important. And also, people are not staying attuned and paying attention to what is happening in this country either. Oh, that was so 2 months ago. We were worried about that. That little democracy thing that we were worried about. You know, I wanted to talk a little bit about Andrew Torba's book, which continues, correct me if I'm wrong, to be an Amazon bestseller. His book is Christian Nationalism, A Biblical Guide for Taking Dominion and Disciplining Nations.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted your thoughts on it and why we should even care that this book exists. But the wave upon wave of anti-Semitism that is strengthening and growing, I think we have to talk about it, because there's this belief that people who are not as attuned to these movements as you are, there's this belief that these fanatical Christians have some view of religious freedom that they don't actually have. This view of caring about all people of faiths, and they just want their own. And so I just wanted your thoughts on this connection. And do you want to say anything about the book in general that you think is important?
Well, I think, first of all, your point about sort of religious freedom is fascinating, because there is this sort of assumption that Christians are okay with religious pluralism. And let's be very open here. There are a lot of Christians who are absolutely okay with religious pluralism. We see that expressed beautifully at like institutions like the National Council of Churches, where people have interfaith dialogue and all sorts of great, wonderful interreligious conversations. Beautiful. There are also far right Christians who do not like religious pluralism and for whom religious freedom should only be for them. Religious freedom is great if it's for persecuted Christians. And by persecuted Christians, they're not talking about actual Christians who have experienced persecution in the Middle East or in other parts of the world, in Egypt, but they're talking about white American Christians who they believe are being currently persecuted by the so-called progressive secular state of America right now, of American politics. They believe that their religious freedoms are being taken away. I think that was exceptionally expressed during COVID when tons of far-right Christians came out and said, we can't go to church because of COVID health protocols. This is infringing on our religious freedoms, right? There were court cases. All sorts of journalists wrote about this. It's really fascinating to watch in real time. White American Christians believe they're being persecuted by the state because of public health protocols. So Andrew Torba, I don't know what to say about this book, Sam, except it is a dumpster fire. And it is so anti-Semitic. In my work among far-right Christians, anti-Semitism is just so blatant right now. You know, I've been doing this work since 2017. I have never seen anything like what I have experienced in the past 2 years. I think, and this may be because of the time the pandemic allowed people to be on social media and sort of connect with each other across these disparate geographies and across ideological institutions, but the massive amount of anti-Semitism that I track online and in real life is just overwhelming to me. I have never seen anything like this. And Torba's book is filled with it. I mean, it's just so anti-Semitic. In fact, I have it here in front of me, and he lists in the recommended readings, Logos Rising by Dr. E. Michael Jones, who's been labeled by the ADL as an anti-Semite. He also has Roosh V, who, if any of your listeners know, was a former pickup artist who converted to Russian Orthodoxy, who is also extremely anti-Semitic and who draws on E. Michael Jones constantly in his social media work and his blogs and his podcasts. I mean, this is just filled with anti-Semitism. And Torba's book,
that quote that you read. Oh, can you read that quote?
And chapter 4, which is called This Is Not a Judeo-Christian Movement, he says he's writing to the propagandists or the lazy journalists, as he calls them. And he says, to start, Christianity and Judaism are totally distinct, incompatible, and irreconcilable religions. One religion believes Jesus Christ is the eternally begotten Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, the divine Logos made flesh, and currently reigns over the earth at his Father's right hand. The other believes Jesus is merely a human who is dead and suffering for eternity in hell. These are not minor differences. They are fundamental to the entire Christian and Jewish worldview, respectively. It's just mind-blowing. And then he critiques being called anti-Semitic. But, you know, this is just one of many of the new far-right books that are about Christian nationalism. I think Torba's is interesting because right away from the onset, you know that he's talking about dominionism and he's talking about Christian nationalism. And this idea of disciplining the nations is part of that dominionist impulse that man, as these far-right Christians understand humanity, man has been given dominion over the world. And through that dominionship, which is God ordained in their minds, the world should transform religiously, right? Socially, morally, through the impact of Christianity. So I think that's what we absolutely see in Torba's book.
I wanted to ask, related to this onslaught of anti-Semitism that you were just talking about, last Tuesday, I think it was now, Trump invited virulent anti-Semite, Christian fascist, MAGA moron, yay, formerly known as Cast, to dinner at Mar-a-Lago. And Kanye brought his new bestie, Nick Fuentes. Nick Fuentes, as listeners of the show know, is not, as the Washington Post would like to call him, a far-right activist. He is a Nazi, an open, overt white supremacist, misogynist of the highest order, anti-Semitic to his core, Holocaust-denying Nazi. He is somebody who marched through Charlottesville with a torch proudly. He is someone who chanted, Jews will not replace us. He is someone who was at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th for the fascist coup and reported back afterwards that it was awesome and he wasn't going to pretend that it wasn't. There are many recent things that Fuentes has said recently that I could not even put in my mouth. They are so horrifying. He is very clear on what he is for and what he is against. Very clearly not for democracy, not for suffrage, not for women's rights, LGBTQ rights. The list goes on and on. And I was wondering, how are the communities that you study looking at this? What should we be taking away? Those are two separate questions, but I think that they connect. What are your thoughts on this?
I have been tracking Fuentes for so many years, and it to me was not surprising that he was at dinner with Trump. For him to be there was not a shock to me at all. He is a perfect expression of where the ideological center of far-right Christianity is shifting to. He also, if we recall, is a massive fan of Vladimir Putin. And at his America First rally in early 2022, he shouted Putin, Putin, Putin on the stage to cheers by the audience. And he invited his surprise guest, who happened to be Marjorie Taylor Greene. If we look at sort of the constellation of the far right, you know, Nicholas Fuentes, as horrific as he is just one of many who holds the same views. I think he just happens to be a little bit more open about his views than Trump because he feels like he has nothing to lose. He's never going to run for president or win some sort of seat. I would be shocked if he did. Those who are sort of more conservative in their vocal protests about the same things, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, do win seats. But at the same time, they hold ideological tenets that are the same. Fuentes is, I think, becoming a sort of figure for the right that is both chaotic in the sense that he just opens his mouth on these live streams and just says these horrific things that nobody wants to repeat. And at the same time, he's sort of becoming this expression of political freedom that many find appealing. And I think that's what we see Ye and Trump really homing in on, is the fact that he speaks to a group of the far right and arguably just a lot on the right in general who want to sort of voice their opinions but can't, and who desire political freedom, freedom from what they often see as like this two-party tyranny.
I agree completely. And I think that there is a unnerving to me mainstreaming of Fuentes' ideology.
Yeah. You know,
and I think that people underestimate, there's not that much that's unique, mm-hmm. that he holds that much, or many, I should say, of the people
right.
that are in power hold.
Yeah.
And I think that that is worth paying attention to. And I mean, and you can see that in who has condemned, you know, right. this Nazi.
Right.
Who has denounced or even distanced themselves
right.
in any way.
And let's remember, like, you know, one of his, I would say, fellow travelers in these circles, Lauren Witzke, ran a really compelling campaign just a few years ago as a Republican nominee for the state of Delaware for the Senate. I mean, she lost ultimately, but her campaign was exceptionally compelling. She didn't lose by that much. And she holds many of the same ideological values, and she was vocal about them, that Fuentes does. So I think that you're correct. We are seeing a mainstreaming of it. And to sort of downplay it by saying, well, the midterms weren't that bad, that does a lot of damage, I think, in American politics. Because if we're not taking seriously the threat of these sort of hybrid forms of fascism that are rising in the United States, then before we know it, we may see another January 6th.
Yeah, I think it is past time that people wake up and smell the fascism that is brewing. It's brewing, and it's brewing more vengeful, more vicious, more determined.
And more globally connected.
And I think that that's part of what strengthens it. They're yeah. not doing it alone. I think that this is just another sign of how far things have come and where we're heading if this dynamic continues. I wanted to thank you for going on this journey with us and talking with us. And I wanted to ask if there were any final myths you wanted to bust, any things that we didn't get a chance to talk about that you wanted to bring up.
No, I think this was such a rich conversation and I really enjoyed talking with you. And despite the very depressing content that we've covered, I had a great time. So, thanks, Sam.
You know, we talk about this a lot, about that these are upsetting things. They are real things. Yeah. And there's a lot we can do, but there's nothing that we can do if we don't look at it. Frankly, if people want to connect with you, your scholarship, your thoughts, where do you want people to be directed to?
They can find me at Twitter at Riccardi Swartz. And I also have a website, which is RiccardiSwartz.com.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. We want to hear from you. Share your thoughts, questions, ideas for topics or guests, or lend a skill. Tweet me at Sam B. Goldman. Drop me a line at SamanthaGoldman@RefuseFascism.org. Or leave a voicemail by visiting anchor.fm/refuse-fascism and hitting the message button. Want to support the show? It's simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And of course, follow, subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can also literally put it on your forehead with our Refuse Fascism beanies available at refusefascism.org and start the conversation. Chip in to support our pod and content creation. Tell people understand and act to stop the fascist threat. It's pretty obvious. We have no sponsors. We count on you. Whether you can give $5 or $50, it all makes a difference in producing and promoting this independent weekly podcast. So if you're able to, please give today by visiting refusefascism.org and hitting that donate button. Thanks to Richie Marini and Lena Thorne for helping produce today's episode. Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each episode. So be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox each week. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.